supervised by Laurent Friedel, and this is work in collaboration also with Florian Girelli. And this paper is available on the archive. So we're interested in the discretization of gauge theories and gravity in particular, such that gauge invariance is preserved. Doing this for gravity is a major unsolved problem. So this work I'm going to present here is based on these two papers in which we separate discretization into two steps. So the first step is subdivision or decomposition into subsystems. And the second step is truncation or coarse graining of these subsystems. So this is a work by Laurent, Mark, Jonathan, Maite, and Florian, of which we've based this, we've expanded into this work. And we're going to combine this with the work by William and Laurent and Mark, and with some inspiration from Carlo, where the presence of boundaries in gauge theories introduces new degrees of freedom that we call edge modes, which may be used to dress observables and render them gauge invariant. And new boundary symmetries, which transform these edge modes and control the gluing map between subsystems. So in this work that I'm going to present here, we rigorously discretize 2 plus 1 gravity with a zero cosmological constant while keeping track of the boundaries of the subsystems and the corresponding edge modes, symmetries, and charges. And as will be shown in detail below, we find relations between several phase spaces, the continuous phase space of piecewise flat and torsionless geometries, the discrete spin network phase space of loop gravity, and the phase space of a collection of particle-like curvature and torsion defects. Okay, so now let me start by just reminding you a bit about flat 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity, so gravity with a zero cosmological constant. So I'm going to take G to be a Lie group, which could be SU2 or could be something more general. And in my notation here, bold font always denotes algebra elements. So if it's bold, it's algebra. If it's not bold, it's in the group. I have a 2 plus 1 dimensional manifold, M. And I have a 2-dimensional spatial manifold, sigma. And I have these geometric variables. So there's a connection one-form, a frame field, curvature, and torsion. The action is defined by E dot F, where I just use the dot product as a shorthand for the Killing form. And that also includes the wedge product. And the equations of motion are simply that there is no curvature or torsion. And from this action, we can find the symplectic potential, which is E dot delta A. So now I'm going to explain what I mean by edge modes. So let's consider a generalized Euclidean gauge transformation. So the connection transforms as we usually, it usually does. And G is the rotation parameter. The frame field also transforms with this additional term that depends on Z, which is a translation parameter. So this has a rotation and a translation, therefore it is a Euclidean transformation. So When we do this, we find that on shell, the action is invariant, but the symplectic potential transforms with a boundary term shown here that depends on these transformation parameters Z and G. And here I have this delta is just a shorthand for this Maurer-Cartan form, delta G, G inverse on field space. The connection and frame field can be dressed by adding new boundary degrees of freedom, and these are the edge modes, in order to make them, and therefore the symplectic potential, to be invariant. A new boundary symmetry algebra is introduced, which transforms the edge modes, as we'll see shortly. Okay, so now I can start talking about what we do. So as an analogy, I'm showing here a map of Waterloo. And here at the center, you can see Perimeter Institute and this nice lake next to it. And this represents the spatial manifold, sigma. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to decompose it into subsystems. So this blue graph, it represents the spin network gamma. Of course, it doesn't have to be squares. It can be anything, but this is just the easiest thing to draw. And now, what we would like to do is we would like to keep only the relevant gauge invariant observables from each of these subsystems. So let's assume that the only way to probe the geometry, so the curvature and the torsion, is using holonomies along loops of the spin network. So as far as observables are concerned, it doesn't matter how I arrange the things inside the loop. So these two pictures are basically the same. The value of the holonomy along the loop is going to be the same thing. And here, when I talk about holonomies, they are both rotational and translational holonomies, again, as we'll see shortly. So more precisely, if I have a loop in the spin network, which I call gamma V, and V is going to be a label for the loop, and I have the Cartan subalgebras of the Lie algebra G, I define Cartan elements, I'm going to call them MV and SV, and they encode all of the gauge invariant information we can obtain about the geometry inside the loop. We'll see below that M and S are the charges of the edge mode symmetries, and they have the same value whether the geometry inside the loop is continuous, concentrated only at one point, or anything in between. Okay, so here is what we get. So we took every loop in this spin network and we truncated the information inside it and we kind of concentrated it at disks at the middle that represent these values of M and S for each of the loops. And here's a legend for what we're going to be doing next. So there is a loop here, gamma V. The blue is the spin network. This is a node of the spin network. It's called C star, and this notation will be clear in a second. And here's a link connecting two nodes, and I'm going to call it E star. Again, you'll understand why in a second. So now I'm going to introduce a dual cellular decomposition. So basically, to each of the blue links, E star, we assign a red dual edge E. And here's what we get if we take off the spin network. So now there is a cell here. It's called C for cell. There's an edge, E, for edge. There's a vertex, V. And it's surrounded by this disk that we call V star. So if I put everything together, what I can see is that each cell is dual to a node. So C is dual to the node C star. The edge E is dual to the link E star. The loop gamma V is dual to this vertex V. And there's this disk here around the vertex. So let's summarize this construction. So we have a spin network graph gamma dual to a cell of the composition delta, such that each link of the spin network is dual to an edge. Each node of the spin network is dual to a cell. And each vertex is regularized by an infinitesimal disk and dual to a loop of the spin network. And these cells, the red ones, describe a piecewise flat and torsionless geometry. So this geometry is completely flat and torsionless everywhere on the interior of each cell. And the curvature and torsion are concentrated at the vertices of the cells. They are distributional, so they're proportional to delta functions centered at the vertices. And they depend on these Cartan elements M and S, as will be shown below. Any questions so far? All right. So now I'm going to start discretizing. And I'm going to define the holonomy variables inside the cells. So in each cell C, I define HC of X, which is a dressed rotational holonomy. And you'll see soon what I mean by dressed. From the node C star at the center of the cell to some point X in the cell. And there's YC, which is the same, except it's a translational holonomy instead of a rotational holonomy. So again, remember that we're dealing with a Euclidean group. So it has a rotational part and a translational part. And using these holonomies, the connection and frame field are given by these expressions. So it's easy to calculate and see that the curvature and torsion inside the cell, as calculated using A and E as defined here, are actually they vanish. Also, this relation for the connection in terms of the dressed holonomy may be inverted, and we find this relation. So here there's a path exponential of the connection from the node C star to some point X. So this is a holonomy. And here, this HC of C star is the dressing part. So if HC was just a holonomy, I would expect the holonomy from C star to itself would be the identity. But here, in this case, it is not, in general, the identity. So this part actually conveys extra information that cannot be obtained from the connection alone. And similarly for the translational holonomy, in general, it doesn't vanish with the argument of the node itself because it is a dressed holonomy. Okay, so here's a nice picture. This is a cell. There's a node here at the center of the cell. The cell is flat and torsionless. The curvature and torsion are at the vertices of this cell. And the holonomy, or the dressed holonomy, HC of X, is basically this path that takes me from the node to some point X. Okay, so now inside those disks that are surrounding the vertices, we can do an analogous thing. So we define a dressed rotational holonomy from the vertex at the center of the disk to some point x on the disk. So I call this hv of x. And similarly, I define a translational holonomy. And as before, they are dressed. So in general, hv of v is not the identity, and yv of v is not the identity. So then the connection and frame field are given inside this disk by these expressions. So let's look at the connection. The first part looks exactly like the connection on the cell, except C is replaced by V. But then we have a second part that actually depends on M, which is this variable that gives me the curvature. And it also depends on phi, which is the angular coordinate on the disk. And similarly, for the frame field, we have the first term, which is the same as the one on the disk, except with C replaced with V, and then a second term that depends on M and S. And if you calculate the curvature and torsion, you find that indeed, as we assumed before, they are distributional, and the coefficient of the delta function is given by something that depends on M and S. So this disk that I'm talking about, as you can read in more details in the paper, is actually a punctured disk, so it does not include the vertex itself. Since the vertex is not inside the disk, it's on its boundary, this delta function just means that the disk itself, the punctured disk, is flat and torsionless. Okay, so for the next step, I defined these holonomies, dressed holonomies inside each cell, but what happens when I go from one cell to the other? So the connection and the frame field must be continuous when moving between cells. So here I have a cell C and a cell C prime. And I define this constant group element HCC prime. And similarly, I define a constant algebra element. And then if you actually demand that the connection and frame field are continuous along this boundary between the cells, then you find that these relations must be satisfied. So HCC prime and YCC prime give us the transition between one cell to the other. So let's look at this expression. So on the left side, we have HC prime of X. So this is the holonomy from the node C prime to X over here. On the right-hand side, I have HC of X. So this is this holonomy. And HC prime C, which takes me from here to here. So you can see that to get from the node C prime to the point X, I can either go through the left-hand side of the equation, HC prime of X, or from the right-hand side, I can start from here, HC prime C takes me to here, and then HC of X takes me to here. So it's basically two equivalent ways to go from one place to the other. And similarly, I can do the same on the disks. So I have a cell C and a disk V star, and I introduced HVC and YVC, and then I have these relations, which are now more complicated because they include the fact that there is curvature and torsion as encoded by M and S. But it works in the same way. So if you look at this first equation, then on the left-hand side, I'm just going from the node C to the point X using the holonomy HC of X. And on the right-hand side, I have a string of three different things I'm doing. So first of all, HCV takes me from the node C to the vertex V. And then there's an exponential M phi. This is basically this small arc here. So it rotates me from phi equals zero until the value of phi that corresponds to the angle of X. And then I have HV of X, takes me from here to the point X. Any questions so far? No? Okay. So now I have two commuting actions that act on these dressed holonomies. So I have four dressed holonomies, HC, YC on the cells, HV, YV on the disks. And the right action takes zero form parameters, G and Z, and transforms as the right action transforms. And it imposes the gauge transformation that we've seen before. The connection transforms in the usual way. The frame field transforms with this translational parameter. Now, for the left action, first of all, let's define H, the Cartan subgroup. And here's the Cartan subalgebra. And we define constant rotation parameters. So for cells, I have GC, which is a group element. For the disks, I have GV, which is a Cartan element. And similarly, I have constant translation parameters, ZC in the cells and ZV in the disks. And I do that for each cell and disk. So then the left action is defined as follows. And interestingly, it leaves the connection and the frame field invariant. So it represents a new boundary symmetry for the edge mode degrees of freedom, or for the dressings of these holonomies. And interestingly, on the vertices, it's generated by the charges M and S. And since the left and right action commute, these charges are actually gauge invariant, which is what we wanted. Okay, good. So now I'm going to go to actually discretizing the symplectic potential of my theory. So the first thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to decompose theta, which remember was an integral over the whole manifold. So I'm going to decompose it into a sum of theta C over each cell, C, and theta V over each disk. So you can see here that each cell inside it has a theta C, each disk has a theta V. And now I look at the boundary of the cells. So the cells, in our definition, they don't actually contain the disks that surround them. The disks kind of eat into the cells. So the boundary of each cell is composed of edges. So I label the edge CC prime, where C prime is an adjacent cell. So for example, here you can see the cell C in the center. Here there's a cell C1. This is the edge CC1. Okay, so here in this case, there's of course four edges, one for each adjacent cell. And importantly, the edge CC prime is the inverse of the edge C prime C. These edges are oriented. I also have arcs that I label CV, where V is an adjacent disk. So again, this is C at the center. Here I have the disk V1. And this is the arc CV1. And in this particular case, I have four arcs. Okay, what about the disks? So since we said before, the disks are punctured, and so they don't contain the vertex V. the boundary of this punctured disc is composed of the vertex, then, and the arcs, which I label VC, where C is an adjacent cell. So this is the disc V star. This is right in the middle is the vertex V, which is on the boundary of the disc. Here is a cell C1, and this is the arc VC1. And also the arcs are oriented, and the arc CV, which is when I look from V, from C into the disc, is the inverse of the arc VC. So now, if I use Stokes' theorem on my integrals, I can see that I can take this sum over cells and disks. I use Stokes' theorem, so now I have here integrals over the boundaries of the cells and disks, and I get three sums, a sum over the edges, a sum over the arcs, and a sum over the vertices. So let's talk about each of these three terms individually. So the first term here is the edge term. On each cell, we plug in the connection and frame field in terms of the dressed holonomies HC and YC. And we get this expression, where again, this capital delta is just a shorthand for the Mauer-Cartan form on field space. After rearranging the sum, so here I have an integral over the boundary of the cell, and I have that for each cell, so then each edge has two contributions, one from each of the two cells, C and C prime, sharing the edge, and these two contributions have opposite orientation because C, C prime is the inverse of C prime C. So what I get for the edge term is the difference between the contributions from each side of the edge. Now, using the continuity conditions that we defined before, we can simplify this to this expression. So again, this capital delta is actually delta HC C prime times its inverse. And HC C prime is what we defined before as the transition from one cell to the other. And I took this out of the integral because this is actually a constant. So now I define the flux along the edge as follows. And then my symplectic potential on this edge looks like this. Now, if I write it in this way, we can see that we've obtained the familiar spin network phase space, T star of G. Right, so here I have delta H, H inverse X, where H is the holonomy along the link connecting one node to another node. And X is the flux along the edge that is dual to that link. Okay, so that was the first term in my symplectic potential. And now I have the second term, which is a sum over arcs. So I can do the exact same calculation, and I find this expression, where now the first term includes the holonomy from the vertex to the cell. And the flux also depends on these variables M and S. So again, it's a spin network phase space. But now the holonomy is from the vertex to the node, and I have the flux along the arc. And note that here, again, like before, the flux is dual to the holonomy. So the arc is actually dual to this line segment that connects the vertex to the node. Okay, the third term is the vertex term. And after some calculations, which you can see in many more details in the paper, we obtain this expression. So here I have the vertex flux XV, which depends on YV of V, which remember is the edge mode. And it's dotted with delta M. And here I have a term that again depends on S and M and this edge mode. And here we have this other edge mode, HV of V. So what does this term mean is something that we've took us some time to find out. So if we define the position Q and momentum P, so here Q is this vertex flux acted on by HV, and P is the mass, or M, acted on by HV, then we can write the potential in this way. And we can interpret it as the phase space of a relativistic particle with position Q, momentum P, mass M, and spin S. And again, note this, the phase space variables here contain the edge modes, HV of V and YV of V. So what happened exactly is that since each edge is shared by two cells, and each arc is shared by a cell and a disk, as we've seen before, the edge mode contributions from each side of the edge or arc cancel. So the edge modes on the cells and the arcs don't appear in the symplectic potential. However, the edge modes on the vertices, the corners of the cells, have nothing to cancel with, and this is why they survive. Okay, so in conclusion, this is the full discretized symplectic potential that we found. So here I have the first term is a sum over all the links, and there's a spin network phase space with a holonomy and flux on each of the links. And the second term is a sum over all of the arcs, and again there's a holonomy and flux. So I have a spin network phase space per arc. And the third term is, it describes particle-like defects with the degrees of freedom being the edge modes. Any questions so far? Okay, very good. So we have on this phase space few constraints. So here is the Gauss constraint. In the continuum, it just imposes that the torsion vanishes everywhere except on the vertices. In the discrete theory, we find that we have one constraint on each cell and each disk. On the cell, we have the Gauss constraint takes this form. So on the left-hand side, I have a sum of all the fluxes on the edges of the cell. And on the right-hand side, I have the sum of all the fluxes on these arcs. And this, you can think about it as just telling me that the sum of all the fluxes around the boundary of the cell, which includes both the edges and the arcs, is just sums to zero. On the disks, I have the Gauss constraint takes this form. So on the left-hand side, I have a sum over all the arcs around the disk. And on the right-hand side, I have a contribution that depends, again, on this M and S, the mass and spin, or the curvature and torsion. Interestingly, this Gauss constraint generates the rotational part of the symmetry transformations corresponding to the left action that I introduced earlier. So recall that this is the edge mode symmetry, which leaves the connection and frame field invariant. And also, this constraint is actually satisfied identically in our construction. Now for the curvature constraint, In the continuum, it imposes that the curvature vanishes everywhere except on the vertices. In the discrete theory, we have this relation for each vertex. And what does this relation mean exactly? Well, let's see. So on the left-hand side, I have a product of the holonomies along the links of this loop. So here's HC1, C2, here's HC2, C3, and so on. On the right-hand side, I have HC1V. So it's this holonomy that takes me from this node to the disk. And then I have exponential of M. So this is a full circle of 2π degrees around this disk. And then I have HVC1 takes me back from V to this node. So you can think about it in two ways. Either you take the right-hand side and you move it to the left-hand side, and then you get that the holonomy along this path that goes around the cell and then goes around the disk, the holonomy along this path is actually equal to the identity, which means there's no curvature inside this path, which indeed is our assumption. So all of this is flat, and the curvature is just inside this disk, which is not inside the path that we took. Or you can think about it as, okay, if I take the holonomy around these four links of the spin network, then on the right-hand side, I get this curvature that lies inside the loop. The curvature constraint generates the translational part of the symmetry corresponding to the left action. And like the Gauss constraint, it's also satisfied identically. Okay, so now I can actually use the curvature constraint, which generates this left action symmetry transformation. I can choose a particular transformation parameter which considerably simplifies things. So XV, the flux on the vertex, becomes simply the edge mode YV of V. And the vertex Gauss constraint simplifies, so I lose the M dependence, and I only have that the sum of the fluxes on the arcs around the vertex is equal to the spin. So now, all of this is in the paper, but now I'm going to tell you a bit about stuff that is not yet in the paper, but will be in a future one. This is kind of new thoughts that we had. So if we assume that the spin vanishes for all of the vertices, so that means there are no torsion defects, then we may shrink the disks to points. So when we shrink the disks, the length of all of the arcs becomes zero, and we can take these fluxes along the arcs, we can take all of them to be zero. So we couldn't do that if S was not equal to zero, because then it's impossible for the sum of all of these zero fluxes to be equal to a non-zero spin. But we take S to zero, then we can actually take all of these fluxes to zero. And then the cell Gauss constraint, which remember looked like this. So now the right-hand side of this constraint becomes zero. And so this cell Gauss constraint is simply that the sum of fluxes around the cell vanishes, which is the correct constraint for loop gravity. The vertex potential becomes that of a spinless particle, so it's just Q delta P. Therefore, the torsionless case, S equals zero, corresponds to the usual loop gravity phase space, along with a collection of curvature defects. Okay, so I have this first term is unchanged, it's just the sum over links, and I have a loop gravity phase space per link. The second term, the one for the arcs, vanishes because now the fluxes on the arcs are zero. And the vertex term just reduces to Q delta P. Okay, very good. So now what we can also do is we can freeze the edge modes. And to explain what that means, let's recall that the position and momentum, we define them like this. So the position depends now on y. It was x before, but now that we did this simplifying transformation, it's just the edge mode y. And the momentum depends on m. We can interpret yv of v as the position in the rest frame, and m as the rest mass. And then you can see that hv of v acts like a Lorentz transformation. So if we set these edge modes, yv of v and hv of v, to the identity, we're basically undressing the holonomies, the dressed holonomies that we have used so far. Then, of course, we get that the position is now zero, because this is zero, and the variation of hv is zero, because the variation of the identity is zero. So the potential on the vertex actually vanishes completely. So since before we just had the loop gravity phase space plus these particle-like defects, and now these particles have actually vanished from phase space, then we just get the loop gravity phase space. So it is a special case of the full space, phase space, where the geometry is torsionless, so we could take S equal to zero, and the edge modes are frozen. So we simply get that the symplectic potential is just a sum over links, there is a Gauss constraint, and the a loop of holonomies around a loop gives me dependence on the curvature. Another thing we could do is, instead of shrinking the disks, we can shrink the cells. Or equivalently, we can expand the disks. So if we do that, the boundary of each disk is now identified with the actual spin network loop that contained the disk before. The edges now have zero length, so these fluxes vanish. And therefore, the spin network symplectic potential vanishes when you just have this arc term and this vertex term. If we furthermore assume that the torsion vanishes, then we again can take the fluxes on the arcs to be zero, and we just get this phase space Q delta P for each vertex. So, in conclusion, in the spinless case, the phase space may be reduced to a collection of particle-like curvature defects. Okay, so in summary, we found a relation between the continuous phase space of piecewise flat and torsionless geometries, and the discrete spin network phase space of loop gravity, coupled to a collection of particle-like curvature and torsion defects. In the torsionless case, which we discussed in the last few slides, we found a relation between the loop gravity phase space alone and the phase space of particle-like curvature defects. So some future plans. This defect picture in our formalism suggests a new perspective for addressing the problem of the continuum limit. possibly related to the work of Clément, Bianca, and Aldo. In 2+1 dimensions, we can extend this formalism to include a dual polarization in which the holonomies and fluxes switch places. So what I mean by that is that we actually find, instead of the holonomies being on the links and the fluxes on the dual edges, we find that the fluxes are on the links and the holonomies on the dual edges. And there's a paper that is almost done. It's going to appear soon, which describes this dual polarization. But the most challenging task is to generalize our formalism to the physically relevant case of 3+1 dimensions. So in this case, the cells are going to be three-dimensional, and the spin network loops will encircle the edges of the cells. This is work in progress, but we've actually already been able to show that these piecewise flat and torsionless geometries in 3+1 dimensions satisfy the Gauss vector and scalar constraints of loop quantum gravity. Thank you for listening.
No questions? No questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker again then.
Thank you.